Hey there, rap heads. In this episode, I'll be sitting down with Gayson Tavat, director of The Justice of Bunny King. Bunny King, played by Essie Davis, is a headstrong mother of two with a sketchy past. Using her razor-sharp wit to charm money from gridlocked motorists by washing their windows, she saves every cent to get back the custody of her kids. After promising her daughter a birthday party, Bunny must fight social services and break the rules to keep her word, but in doing so, risks losing her children altogether. Accompanied by her niece, Tanya, played by Thomasin McKenzie, a fierce teenager running away from home, Bunny is in a race against the clock and headed towards an epic showdown with the authorities. I ask Acern about her journey as a director, what it was like directing her first feature film, and what the film says about our society today. Stay till the end as I take Acern through the ultimate lightning round series of questions. Welcome, Gayson. How you doing? Thank you so much for being on the program. How about we just start something easy with a little introduction of yourself to our listeners?
Right. Well, I'm Gayson Tavat. I live in New Zealand. I'm a New Zealand Chinese filmmaker, I suppose. been here since I was 2 years old and been working in the film industry probably since I was 18 years old. Justice of Bunny King's my first feature film.
I would love to talk about the film. You mentioned that you kind of got into filmmaking. What ultimately did get you into filmmaking? Well, first of all, what did you do prior? And did you always feel like you wanted to get into filmmaking?
Well, I mean, I started off in the camera department. I was always really interested in photography. And then I, you know, a natural progression for me seemed to be, you know, was to move into the moving image. But at the time, you know, this was, you know, a number of years ago, there weren't a lot of women filmmakers and there certainly, you know, weren't a lot of Asian filmmakers. And so at the time, I didn't really think that, you know, there was any possibility that I could become a director. So I started off working in the camera department. I did that for about 10 years. But actually, it was a really formative experience because I became very comfortable working on film sets, you know, and very comfortable around, I guess, the technical aspects, the practical aspects of filmmaking. You know, a film set can be an incredibly intimidating place if you haven't spent much time on one. And I guess the benefit of spending that time was that I don't get intimidated by big crews or the people or the, you know, all the mechanics of a set. That's, you know, it's kind of second nature to me because I kind of grew up on film sets.
I mean, I definitely think it does translate onto the film. Even for like a first full feature film, it seems like you've nailed all the nuances and all the, like the technical aspects, like you said, of putting together a film. Do you have a moment kind of early on in your career, especially being on set, that ultimately kind of put in your brain, hey, I kind of want to be a director, or have you always wanted to be a director? Because there's so many roles on a film set, right? There's so many different components about a film set. What about directing that kind of made you gravitate towards it?
I just found myself standing beside the camera and getting frustrated sometimes. I'd be like, why don't they do this? You know, like just, I can't say that. I'm just the camera assistant, you know. And then, well, you know, and then towards the end of my career, I was like, I was actually going up to the director and suggesting things.
Excuse me, I have notes.
and so quite often they'd go, oh, actually, that's a really good idea.
Right?
They'd go, oh, right, okay. And then I just sort of, you know, and then I just went, you know what? I think I could do this. I think I could do this. You know, I stood beside the camera. I watched directors working for years with actors, and then I thought I could do this. And of course, it's not that simple because you know you actually have to create something from the ground up. And I think there's an interesting sort of separation actually between the people who work on sets once the project is green lit and it's up and running and the money is flowing. That's quite different to when you don't have a project green lit and there's no money and you're working by yourself and you're staring at blank pages. And nobody really is interested at that point. That's a completely different kettle of fish that I had to learn about.
I love the confidence. I love how even early on you're like, yeah, I could probably do this. Because sometimes that's half the battle, right? You just need like the confidence to be able to do something because then you become like basically a sponge to learn all the different things that you need to be successful. Where does that come from? Does your family have a history of being able to do things from the ground up and having the confidence of things? Like, what was it like growing up for you to kind of develop that confidence?
I don't know. I think I was always a tomboy. I mean, I'm a queer filmmaker, so I've always been, I guess, a feminist in that regard. So I've always, I guess, cognizant of the gender politics around not stepping back and going, actually, I need to step forward, you know, rather than being, I guess, being content with playing a secondary role. And then I came from a family of all girls. I've got three sisters, so
all right,
that probably had a bit to do with it as well.
Are you oldest? Where are you, middle, youngest?
I'm the oldest.
And what's it like being the oldest?
You do a lot of conflict resolution and management in a family, you know.
That's where the directing skills come from.
Come in handy. Somebody's always not talking to the other one, and you and I have to do a lot of smoothing over, and, you know.
Yeah. There you go. That's the key right there. You're like, listen, I know how to direct a set. I've got two younger sisters. I know how to politic and make sure everyone's kind of happy in some way. You know, that's really cool. And it's really great that you come from a background of strong women. Even in this film, you know, I'd read that a lot of the core crew that you had on set was all women. And that's just, I think that's so important that not only is the female empowerment shown on screen, but behind the scenes as well. And that's something that I think we are starting to see finally more and more of in filmmaking. I read that when Gregory David King came to you with this project, you didn't actually think this project particularly would be your first feature film that you wanted to make. Would you be able to share why and what you originally had in mind for a first feature?
Well, he came to me with this story, and it was actually, the character was in a different story. There's a little bit of misunderstanding there. He came to me with this script, and it had this character, Bunny, in it, who I absolutely loved. But the story that she was in was a story that didn't quite resonate with me. So I said to him, I just love this character so much. Can we take her and put her into a film that A, lands with me, and B, is a bit simpler? Because I knew being my first feature film, I had to tell a relatively simple story, and it had to be, you know, it couldn't be a big budget thing. It couldn't be, you know, anything that was too indulgent, because I probably wouldn't be able to raise the money to make it. And so, yeah, Bunny sort of moved from one story into another story, and that's how she evolved and how the film evolved.
Do you know that the character Bunny came, it is like a inspiration of someone particular, or is it more of like an amalgamation of just a characteristics that's put into one body?
She's a whole lot of characters rolled into one. Right. I mean, when we first started outlining the story, there's been a lot of instances of women like Bunny who've had their children removed, and it's really more a symptom of society and how it is punitive on single women and mothers. And in the news, there's just always these dreadful stories, you know, probably once a week or, you know, every other day about, you know, somebody who's really struggling on the breadline and they've done something because they needed to survive. And so, and that's kind of where it evolved from. And, you know, and I grew up, you know, part of Auckland, West Auckland, you know, and there were a lot of single mothers there as well. My own mother was a single mother for a time. So, you know, growing up, you know, I could draw on all these, you know, what I'd watched, I see, you know, I suppose, and the characters that I'd come across, and my own mother, my friends' mothers, just seeing and remembering, you know, the characteristics and qualities and the things that they had to go through to, you know, to raise their kids or keep their kids.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, oftentimes when you do read those stories, and for many people, they often read like the headlines or even like the report on it. The oftentimes assumption is like, oh, you know, she had her children taken away. She must have been a bad mother, or she must have done something wrong. It's like you said, it's very punitive, but we don't get the full context of the situation. And, you know, whether in every situation is different, whoever is right or wrong, I think it's important to understand a person's whole situation. And then you look at it and you're like, okay, well, there's a level of understanding that that I would feel that this person's situation is they're in, and then how they've kind of grown or working to overcome it and challenge it. And I think this film is definitely an encapsulation of that. One of the things that, you know, I've noticed throughout the film, as we're following Bunny on this roller coaster of emotions. I will tell you, it is a roller coaster of emotions. We're seeing the moments where Bunny's decision making is questionable in a way, yet we also see that her heart is in the right place. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, she wants to be with her children, and no one can fault her for that. I'm curious, from your perspective as a filmmaker and director, how did you go about making sure you kept that balancing act throughout the film, ensuring not to lose that perspective from the audience?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it is to make sure that it was always, I mean, even though there's lots of, you know, different elements to the story and different techniques that we've used, really, it's a love story at the heart of it. You know, it's a love story between a mother and her kids. But you're right, you know, Bunny makes all these terrible decisions sometimes, reacts in the wrong way. And the trick was, even though, you know, the audience might watch her and go, oh, Bunny, don't do that, we always understand why she does it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, what I wanted the audience to walk away with was to not look at her and go, oh, or look at people like Bunny and go, oh, why are you that way? But instead to go, oh, what happened to you to put you in that situation? Because, you know, nobody would willingly put themselves in that situation. And it's like, what has led you to this point? But in terms of a balancing act, you know, it was important to keep the joy, to keep her courage, to keep her self-determination, and also to keep her wit and humor. You know, that's such an important characteristic. You know, I really wanted the audience to fall in love with Bunny, and for her to break their hearts in a good way.
Yeah.
And I think Essie also found this beautiful way of letting the audience in to who Bunny was, so that, you know, the hooks are in the heart of the audience, but then also to lead them along so that they understand why she's doing stuff, but also to be right there with her. I mean, I did a fundraiser screening here for the Women's Refuge in the town, rather. Mm. And I said to the woman who ran it, I think you should watch this before you show it, you know, just to make sure that you're okay with the kind of film that it is and all that kind of thing. And three of them came up and they watched it and they said that they didn't feel violated watching it. They actually felt that they knew exactly who Bunny was and they were dealing with women like Bunny every day. You know, to me, that felt like I'd really nailed it, that they didn't. Because I think there was always a danger with a film like this that you could almost traumatize the audience more if they'd been through a situation like that. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted them to feel empowered by her, you know.
Yeah. I think also there's also the risk of, quote unquote, like alienating certain audiences, because like you said, there's the potential of watching, and depending on how the narrative is told and after watching the film, you could easily, some people could be like, oh, you know, she should be responsible for her actions. And, you know, if Bunny followed the rules, she wouldn't be in this mess. But even in the movie, I mean, Bunny says explicitly, like, I've done everything you've asked me to do, and I'm kind of, you've left me no choice. And I think that's important that you kind of keep that balancing act throughout the film. I will say that even though you said Bunny, when we said Bunny makes questionable decisions, I think that the decision to punch Bevan in the face in the garage was the correct decision. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. And you see her grappling with that moment as well. She's like, because, you know, she's going to lose the home that she's got if she does that. But, you know, she makes the right decision, you know.
One thing I noticed is that it isn't until the end where we find out the exact details of Bunny's past. I think it's kind of mentioned throughout. And also, you know, I couldn't help but think, I'm like, you know, what kind of put her in this situation? Bunny having to defend her daughter from her father, which led to her being charged of manslaughter, but, you know, because of self-defense. Why was it revealed to the audience at the end of the movie rather than in the beginning?
That's a good question. I guess I wanted to just retain that mystery. And in some ways, you know, I think now I don't even know if I needed that information. I don't know if we needed that backstory. Because really, why do you need to know what she's done because she's in this situation, you know?
Right.
You know, there was so much discussion around the script about, oh, well, we need to know so that we understand. And I mean, I think so many women end up in this situation, and you can almost see why they're there. You don't have to reveal it, you know. So it's one of those things that I kind of wanted to just filter in really sort of lightly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to leave it till the end. So
yeah,
it was probably quite important for Tania's character, who played the social worker at the end, for her to understand, because she is kind of the audience's perspective as well, because it's all about the judgments that we make, and that this character who initially judges her by the end of spending time with her, you know, becomes her advocate and sees what she's been through and sees who she really is.
I noticed that too, that, you know, it wasn't until like the social worker read her file and you can kind of see in her face change a little bit. It's like, oh, you know, like, yes, what she's kind of doing now is not the best way of going about it, but there becomes a layer of understanding where, oh, I see why she's that very protective, because she's had to be very protective almost all her life. And you can kind of sense the compassion kind of come through from the social worker, especially, you know, the social worker being a woman. And, you know, we can presume that maybe she does have a understanding, like maybe she's a mother too. And she goes, I understand. But I also noticed, you know, the gentleman in the film also too, not the best. And I was like, oh God, the detective who's a liar, the creepy real estate guy, and obviously Bevan. And like, these are like the forces that Bunny has to kind of combat against. You can't help but think, you're like, yeah, of course, like she's got to be defensive. I mean, look what she's kind of had to deal with, you know. But and you think about the system that she's kind of going against, you know, it's really interesting. And again, I think you do a great job of kind of keeping that perspective and making sure the audience stays with Bunny.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've had a few people say, oh, the men in the film aren't very nice, are they? but then, you know, but actually there was Simu, who she works with, you know,
Yes, he's the one,
and,
yeah.
You know, and he takes her to his home. So that, you know, there are some nice men in the film.
yes.
But, I mean, I guess the fact is that, you know, the world that she lives in structurally is, you know, controlled by men or men, male created systems, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she's having to shape shift and survive within. And it's, yeah. And I think putting a lens on that and seeing that is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, number one, I think the film is very timely. The audience sees Bunny fighting this system that's keeping her children away, right? And in a way, it's telling her how she should behave, how to act, checking all these boxes. She needs to do this, make sure she's got a house and all this stuff. All these requirements in place by the GFS that dictate whether Bunny can see her family or not, which is kind of crazy. I can't help but think about kind of what's happening here in the States with the overturning of Roe v. Wade and a woman's right to choose. I'm wondering, did you always intend to have that commentary with this film? Or maybe I also think about, does it even speak to how patriarchal our society is that this movie could have been made 20 years ago and it would still have the same effect and message?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. I mean, first of all, I'm really sorry about Roe v. Wade. That was, you know, I couldn't believe that. And I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners feel the same way. But yeah, I think it is probably a testament to the far reaches of the patriarchal society that we're back where we, you know, in the US, you know, there's been a winding back of the clock, and also that these systems are still in place. I mean, what does it take to change them? I don't know. Probably more women in power. And more women in leadership roles, and more diversity in all of our leadership roles. And I don't know how you create greater equality and change systems.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, working with someone like Essie Davis, as established as she is, I love The Babadook, by the way, very frightening, but her performance in that is fantastic. And her performance in this film is fantastic as well. Given the relationship between director and actor, and this being your first feature film, I know that you said you were really comfortable being around sets. Was there anything that you learned or picked up on from a veteran actor like Essie Davis?
Yeah, no, I learned a lot from Essie. You know, I mean, the way that she analyzes a script and character is just phenomenal. She really sort of gets in and she scratches away. We did a script, a pass on the script where once she'd sort of really committed to the role and was immersing herself in it, we did a pass and she was like, Bunny wouldn't say this, Bunny would say it like that, you know. And one of the lines towards the end of the film that makes everybody laugh is when Bunny walks out and she goes, "Oh, this is a shit place for a birthday party." That was Essie's line. She goes, that Bunny would say that. I was like, all right. Yeah. But, you know, her degree of preparation, I mean, she's an absolute perfectionist in her commitment to the role. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting to see the way that she works with other actors as well. She's really generous, but she'll also push other actors to raise their game to meet hers. It was, you know, I found really fascinating. I hadn't seen another actor do that before.
Wow.
But, you know, she's just, yeah, she was so committed. And really, you know, working with an actor of that caliber, you really just have to help them have the script and all the ingredients that they need so that they can, you know, bring their full performance. So we worked with her in character development to make sure she had the clothes so that she could walk right and feel right, that she had the hair that felt right, you know, that everything about her was really three-dimensional about Bunny. And then just creating that space so that she could be Bunny in the space. We didn't have a really prescriptive shooting style. It was more like create the environment, watch what the actors are doing, and then meet, you know, and then we just capture that rather than constructing this whole big thing of, I'll walk here, stand here, hit this mark, look here. You know, that heavy-handed sort of approach I wanted to completely remove. Because a film like this is all about character and it's all about performance. So it was really about stripping it back as much as we can. So those things really took center stage.
Definitely. Again, it does translate very well through the film and beautifully shot, beautifully acted, beautifully directed, put together. The ending, the ending scenes was really gripping. Also, it's like, oh man, when she got shot, I mean, also having Bunny like a sense of humor after getting shot, but I was just like, oh, who pulled the trigger? And it's just, that's a whole nother thing in terms of police authorities being too trigger happy, but we don't have to get into that right now. Before I let you go, I would love to do a quick, fun, lightning round style of questions. Not too difficult, not too much. Just so our listeners can kind of get to know you more on an even deeper level. How does that sound?
Sure.
Don't worry, nothing hard-hitting. Nothing hard-hitting. Okay, number one, if you're going on a 40-mile backpacking trip, what is your go-to snack you're bringing?
Potato chips.
Oh, I've never heard of that. Which ones?
Oh, there's a brand down here called Marlborough Proper Chips, made with Marlborough sea salt, and they're light and they're crispy and they're delicious and very salty.
And are you eating that on the go, or is that like a reward after you've done your hike?
That's the reward once you get to the end of the hike.
There you go. That's the key. Mine used to be Sour Patch Kids, but I went on a backpacking trip recently and someone brought jelly beans. And I was like, jelly beans? That is genius. Because you had all the different flavors and they're hard-coated, so they don't melt too bad. Gets hot over here. Yeah. Yeah. But potato chips is a good idea. I think I might try that.
They don't weigh anything. You know, they're not heavy to carry.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Okay. Next one. Favorite go-to karaoke song?
Eye of the Tiger.
Oh. Yeah. That's a good one. That gets everyone singing too, I'm sure.
Well, it's knowing what's in your range too. I love karaoke, you know.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I went and I was like, I'm never going to humiliate myself by doing that. And after a few drinks, I was like, where's the microphone? and now I love it.
Yeah, that's the key. See, karaoke, the key to karaoke is a good party environment. You want to get everyone loose and liquored up. That definitely helps.
It's a great equalizer, you know, especially if you go
with people
dancing. It's a wonderful equalizer.
100%. That's a good one, though. Eye of the Tiger. Okay. This one is typically tough for people to answer, especially of my Asian folks. Would you rather give up all things rice or all things noodles?
I would give up all things rice. Can't give up noodles.
I'm with you on that one. What's your favorite noodle dish? One of your favorite. That's hard to answer.
I love dan dan noodles. I also love ramen. Dan dan noodles I love. Or also, you know, a spicy wonton soup noodle dish. I can't go past either. Yeah. Actually, and there's also, I love barbecue roast duck noodles as well.
Oh, you're describing a perfect Chinese banquet right now with all the fixins. There you go. Chinese New Year's can't come fast enough, right?
Yeah, I want noodles now.
Okay. What would you say is your biggest pet peeve on set?
Oh, it's people standing around and talking when the light is going down and you know you've got like 10 minutes to get a shot. And it's like, people, we need to rush.
Yeah.
You're standing around talking and it's like, ah.
Yeah.
It's a pet peeve.
Yeah, whenever you're shooting outdoors, it's so many elements that are so out of your control. So, okay, good to know. I'll remember that if I'm ever on set. Last one. We'll see if you can do this. Name something that's cuter than a dog.
Oh my gosh. That's really hard. Name something that's cuter than dog. Dogs are my favorite thing in the whole wide world.
Yeah.
The reflection of the dog. The dog's reflection.
Or a dog doing something cute.
Yeah, so
a
dog
action becomes
cute. Yeah.
So the dog becomes cuter than the current status of cuteness. You know what? Nothing would have been a very acceptable answer because I also think there's nothing cuter than a dog.
No. A puppy. Puppy is cuter than a dog.
Oh, that's true. That's a possible answer as well. That's a good answer. Well, Gaysern, thank you so much for jumping on the pod with me today. And go check out our movie.
Me too. Thank you for having me on your show.